Welcome to the official SBGN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
It's nice to know that there's an audience out there again. I'm pleased to be back, and I hope you're pleased to have me back. Yann de la Folie. Yann de la Folie is across the table from me. He is a researcher and pediatric hepatogastroenterologist, active at the moment in Gießen, although everyone who knows him expects him to be snatched up and deposited in a chairmanship somewhere else sometime soon, because his work deals with artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence as a way of sifting data more finely, sorting it more precisely, and making correlations that the rest of us don't have the time, the patience, or the nose to do to manage on our own. He has organized a presentation that I found absolutely fascinating when I reviewed it online. And to go with that, he's put together three questions that I think ought to frame any discussion of AI and pediatric hepatology, gastroenterology, and nutrition. Those are, what is AI? Good starter. And how can it be applied to pediatric gastroenterology, hepatology, and nutrition? Then what are the disadvantages and risks associated with developing it in medicine and using it in, let's just go with PGHN? And then what do patients and families need to know about data security and about AI? I think it's time for me to step back and just let Yann give us his best, which is certain to be very, very good indeed.
Well, thank you very much, Alex, for the kind introduction. And I'm very happy to be here. And it's just a great honor and pleasure to sit across the table from you and talk with you about AI. If we think about AI and what is AI, obviously artificial intelligence, the history is very fascinating because back in the 50s, the AI workforce was introduced in the UK. And they would try to, at Dartmouth College, and they would try to put up something that would simulate intelligence as we know it, you know, as a property of human behavior. And that was, from a methodological point of view, that was tracing back to the 30s, where obviously Alan Turing and these guys were introducing the idea that machines could imitate intelligence as we know from humans. And that was where the Turing test came from, right? The Turing test is that some machine would have intelligence if we would communicate with it, and we couldn't tell if it was a machine or a human being which is communicating with us. So that was one of the early tests. And nowadays, most of the AI systems do very well in this test. So artificial intelligence in the first place was simulating intelligent behavior as we know it from humans. And back at Dartmouth College, at this project, the 12 scientists who were involved were very confident that they could, within a year or two, they could put up something that would be human-like in terms of intelligence. That didn't work out as well. And from then on, there were periods of high expectations into AI and frustration with AI going back and forth. In a talk last year, it's called an AI winter, so to say, which is the frustrating part, and the AI summer, where there's always much excitement and much enthusiasm. And now we are back in a summer, right?
Lovely to hear, but what were these frosts that nipped the darling buds of May?
That's beautifully put. And
it's Shakespeare, not me.
But still. Well, the first downturn was that the expectations in the 50s, 60s were much too high, and the machinery at that point wasn't as convincing as it should have been. And then the investments in this research, also for application in business, in health, were cut down tremendously by a report in the early 70s that said that it's not worth the money you put in. Mm-hmm. And then in the early 80s, the Japanese government came up with, because there were new computers which were much better, the Japanese government came up with an initiative that they would invest a huge amount of money in computing. At that time, in the 80s, you remember that everything which what came from Japan was considered a high-tech thing because they were overtaking the American economy in terms of producing cars and things like that.
I'm not certain that I'm old enough to remember anything from the 1980s, but... Well, if you insist, okay.
I didn't want to. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't.
For those at home, I'm almost 70 years old, and I remember when Japan was the leader. But moving on from that,
and then the Japanese put a lot of investment in this technology and advanced technology, computer technology. But then again, it didn't work out as well. And the current summer occurred because the machinery, the hardware performances was very high. So a method which is pretty old, which are deep learning methods, which is basically convolutional neural networks, that is reapplied and now can be efficiently applied. It was invented very early, but it couldn't be applied because no computer would be able to make these kind of calculations. But now, from the early 2000s on, the computer performance was improving a lot, and then AI, with especially in deep learning, evolved very nicely, and now we see the results of this coming into healthcare. You know,
that tells us the history of AI, but I'm still not sure that you've defined for us all what AI is.
Well, there are three layers to AI, if you want to. The artificial intelligence is the imitation of human behavior, which is considered intelligent.
As we know it in real life.
Yeah. As we experience it every single day. Uh-huh. And then there's a layer which is called machine learning, which basically implies that machines are able to learn from exposure to a certain training set. Uh-huh. That's a more technical term. And then there's deep learning, which is the most current thing, where it's pretty specific on some learning mechanisms that involve neural networks, but also other algorithms that focus on a more human comparable type of learning from the data.
What makes learning human comparable?
Well, the first things from artificial intelligence, which were very efficient, were expert systems, if you like. Expert systems in the 80s were...
Expert systems, yes. It's,
you might remember this time, were systems where an expert like you would sit across from an IT guy and would just put in his knowledge in a huge database, and then some other person down the line could interact with a computer system which would pose questions from the expert knowledge and would then generate simple decision trees, like when to give an antibiotic to a child that was febrile, that was done in San Francisco.
Or with spell check programs which say, if you begin a word with TH, then think of the, think of that, think of this.
Yeah, that's all already a little, yeah, but basically that could work with an expert system. But back then there was more a question and answer game with a user, you know, and he would answer certain questions and then like a scoring system, and then there would be a decision. But the problem with these systems, they were very high maintenance because the experts' knowledge base would change over time, obviously, and would be very hard to interact with this, and the computers weren't very fast. But this was already AI, if you want, because there was some intelligent behavior associated with it. It seemed like a very good idea, you know. Mm-hmm. But the convolutional neural networks, deep networks, which have a lot of hidden layers, so they have an input layer where the data comes in, they have hidden layers which actually do the computation, and then there's an output layer in the front, that's the depth of the network, the number of layers that is in between. These layers are far more focused on a organic learning, if you like, and especially used in unsupervised learning. So people, you can give a network like this a data set which is not structured, so you don't say on this picture there's a cat, in this picture there's a dog, in this picture there's my younger brother or something like this, but you just give these pictures and then ask the system in an unsupervised setting, how would you sort these pictures? So the system will itself look for ways that make sense to sort this this data set into certain categories. And this clustering can lead to quite surprising results. And we use that a lot when we look at classification problems.
And it can be novel. it can establish connections which we haven't, as humans, yet learned to appreciate.
Yeah, there's some aspects of AI which really are like that, that we always think about along the same lines because we are raised, from mm-hmm. the same type of thinking. So sometimes there can be surprising effects that are visualized or which come to mind from such a data set. And also a big strength is that they can handle huge amounts of data, which are for the human mind very hard to digest, multidimensional data, which needs to be reduced in their dimensionality and which is very hard to understand, and this can be, well, understood is the wrong word, but this can be analyzed by such a system in a very, much more efficient way, especially if you think in integrating multiple data sources, integrating clinical data with multi-omics data from basic research, microbiota, metabolomics, and genetic information. And integrating all this also over time, which requires a huge amount of computations.
Drawing always, as I do, on anecdote, I'm thinking about my experiences in learning Hungarian, where until I learned basic vocabulary items, then the long and, to my initial inspection, highly complex Hungarian words didn't fall into any kind of rational arrangement. But once you learn building blocks, then you see, aha, there are the individual building blocks, there are the joints in the system. And this is what happens when you want to use it in a dative, in an accusative, in a genitive manner. That is deducing pattern from repeated exposure. And which of, I'm happy to call it artificial intelligence on my part because it certainly isn't something, well, anyhow, into which of the categories does that sort of learning fall?
Yeah, that's, you're referring to the language models, which are now very important because the language is a very potent structure because languages across the world are very different in their
yes.
structure, but also they, because they describe a world around them, they need to be somehow consistent in transporting a meaning through language. So it's a very interesting field. And now what has happened to have come to the public a lot was the large language models, because these large language models are very easy to interact with various languages, and they could even create new languages for, if you want to have a movie with your own Alexian language, then such a model could create a language which would make totally sense from other languages that it knows. And it's very easy for these, especially neural networks, to interact with language data.
I find it difficult to communicate in English, and to add an Alexian on top of that seems a bad idea. But in any event, now how do we use these in pediatric hepatogastroenterology and nutrition?
I think we are at the brink of seeing it a lot. If you go into an adult endoscopy suite at the moment, you already see a lot of AI with helping the endoscopist identify adenomas in the colon in real time.
Real time when you have the biopsy forceps there.
Yeah, or before you have the biopsy forceps even from the picture,
uh-huh.
it will analyze the picture and will be very fast in reacting to the picture and identifying some parts of the endoscopist's view, which is not viewed by him, which is in his eye, but it's not in his mind in the right way. So it can alert him to certain areas which he hasn't seen, or it can alert him to some, especially smaller polyps. And if we go, for instance, for surveillance colonoscopy, which is not a pediatric issue so much, but can be, the detection rate of adenomas is increased about a third by such a system. So you will have much more efficient endoscopy in this setting. And then also we have some other big data sets, because now if we go to the field of IBD, we have so many different medications that we can use now in label and off label. And what we all want to know in IBD is what is the right medication for the patient who is sitting in front of me. And that is something that is very difficult, because we all say, we want precision medicine. We want to tailor our therapeutic approach to the one patient who is sitting in front of us. We don't want a one size fit all. But it is very difficult to do so because we don't have the data. And if you want to analyze these big real-world data sets where, thousands of children have received different variants of medication for a various amount of time with other influences, it's very hard to to analyze this type of data without AI. So we hope that clinical decision support will soon be a very important issue, that the precision medicine approach can go further.
I can see the darling buds starting to reopen, or to change the metaphor. I can see that this is throwing off sparks of favorable or advantageous aspects of AI like nobody's business. Really coruscating. But what are the disadvantages to which you wanted to draw our attention?
Well, there are
risks.
It is. If I talk about disadvantages of AI, I'm not referring to the more philosophical problem of the question of control of AI, but it needs to be regulated. You know, there are a lot of dystopic movies which show that AI will take over our world and will just overcome the humankind. So, and I'm not referring to this type of dystopic vision. I'm just more thinking that the disadvantages are, especially in data security and safety, because you're giving away some of your data whenever you interact with an AI. When you go to ChatGPT and interact with this chatbot, it will retain some of the information you gave him about yourself and will retain it for further usage in the communication. And this is easily ignored, you know, it's easy to just
overlooked,
forget.
Yes.
Yeah, overlooked is the right word. And so, especially for children and adolescents, and it will stay with them for a long time, this information they gave away. So it's very important to focus on patient autonomy and on sovereignty over their data. And you know that the biggest AIs in the world at the moment are not in public hands, but are in the hands of commercial offerings, you know, that like Amazon, like Google, and stuff like that. And they will, if they offer an AI, they will get some information back. And this information is not in the hand of Aspigen or if some scientific society, if you talk about disease.
Well, I'm as anti-capitalist as the next man. I think that if we had properly socialized medicine without a need for insurance and personal contributions, then it would make no difference to anyone if it was known that you have an allergy or that your mother died of a breast cancer. It would simply not be relevant to anything that could be disadvantageous in the financial level. And we, as with returning mothers to the workforce and improving nutrition and feeding and all that, if a woman has to go back to work and abandon her baby at 3 months, that's disadvantageous for financial reasons, independent of nursing, independent of feeding. And here we have AI being disadvantageous for reasons independent of the content of the information. Well, I risk going off onto a rant again, so I'll stop. But those are the disadvantages then. Disadvantages are those of giving away something that is somehow precious. And how do we reduce its preciousness except by altering the social structures within which AI is embedded?
Well, now there are important processes at the moment in terms of regulation. In the EU, we had the AI Act early this year, which regulates the usage of AI. And it's a very powerful tool from the regulatory side, which will be used to, you know, confine these risks or to reduce these risks, because the providers of AI will be forced, but will be encouraged to provide more explainable AI, more transparency in the algorithms. They need to be very transparent about the data that they put into an AI algorithm, because that's a very important issue too. When I give my information to an AI algorithm and it's mainly trained on somebody from a population from a totally different country. You know, if you take European data and you put a child from South Asian country into this algorithm, it might give wrong answers because it's trained from a different data set. And also the way the algorithm works, the way it is trained, the hyperparameters which you can adjust the training needs to be transparent. And there's a huge movement in the AI world, which is called explainable AI, where there is more transparency for the human, also the user, but also the healthcare provider who is kind of, you know, making the clinical decision besides, assisted by the clinical decision support system. And that also includes the confidence of the decision. So if the computer says this or this medication would be a very good idea for this person, then it should add, you know, what this data is based on, this decision is based on, and how confident this decision is.
And as with genetic analysis, you need to have this explained to you.
That is very, very important. And this has a human touch to it. So at the moment, the human in the loop aspect of usage of AI in healthcare and in PGH and all the way is very, very important. There will always be the physician who is making the decision with the patient, but perhaps being assisted by an AI system, which just can give information that you base your decision on, because otherwise it's, you know, if you can provide better information for the decision, that's a huge advantage.
Yeah. Well, then, what do patients and families need to know about data security and AI? That's your third question. I think we've come to it in a natural way.
I think it's very important to educate not only healthcare providers, but also patients and their families in the usage of these systems. Because you have these huge, large language models, for instance, and people will interact with it a lot. They already interacted with a Google search machine. It's a common term that somebody Googles his disease or his condition before they come to a doctor. And this also applies to other systems that are more more advanced. But you always give the system some information, and the information that you get returned will do something to you. You might be, you know, worried a lot, and you might go to an emergency department and get a surgery that you didn't need because you were over worried about something.
This is why we have priestesses to interpret the oracle's answers.
That's exactly that is a very nice picture, because you need to have somebody explain to you what this actually means, and that is a very human task, you know. And for parents, the interaction of their child with an AI system can be very threatening, because this AI system might draw some information from the child that it doesn't want to give away, and this information is stored forever, you know. 20 years later, it will be still accessible somewhere. And also, the information usually isn't stored in the places that are very secure, but because if whenever you participate in some commercial AI system, you pretty much sign that they can take your information and store them and things like this. This is also true for navigational systems. You know, if you go with your car and you use the navigation system, it will know where you're going.
I've given up on being a successful serial murderer. I really have.
You've given up on that?
Okay, Jan, on that note, on my failed career as a mastermind criminal, thanks to AI, I need to ask you now, you've brought a song for us to hear. What is that song?
That was the question I was thinking about most when you gave it to me, because that was very, very difficult. I thought about a high class song that I could show.
Oh no, just stay with who you are. Don't go high class.
Yeah, and that's what I figured. So I took a song from a band that I know personally from a long time ago, from the city where I'm from in Germany. That's called Gießen, and it's called Die perfekte Welle, the perfect wave, so to say, and it's about your attitude to life. I think it's very beautiful.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Wipe out! Sorry, we've just fallen off our surfboard. It's time to go. Bye-bye, Jan. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.